Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight.
This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge. And unity is the path forward. And we must meet this moment as the United States of America.
A new administration, Joe Biden calls for unity as he and Kamala Harris are sworn in and start a new chapter in American history after four tumultuous years. Then, the Biden agenda. The new president confronts the many challenges facing the country with a list of initiatives and executive orders on day one. Plus, securing democracy. The transition of power is ensured with a massive show of force in Washington and across the country. And the art of inauguration. Public installations stand in for crowds at a ceremony subdued by COVID-19 and security concerns. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. This day has seen the inauguration of Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. as the 46th President of the United States. He was sworn in today to lead the nation into the post-Trump era, facing the worst public health crisis in a century and deep political divisions. And Vice President Kamala Harris, the first woman, first Black, and first Asian to serve in that role, was sworn in on this historic day. John Yang begins our coverage.
Today's was an inauguration unlike any other before. Missing were the usual crowds, banished due to concerns about security and the pandemic, and replaced on the National Mall by 200,000 flags. Taking the oath as vice president,
I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
The first woman and first woman of color. And the oldest person ever elected to the nation's highest office took the presidential oath.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
Mr. Biden used the family Bible on which he had twice taken the vice presidential oath and seven times as senator.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Standing in front of the U.S. Capitol, still scarred by this month's deadly assault by a pro-Trump mob, the 46th president called for unity.
We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed. Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation. And I ask every American to join me in this cause.
He acknowledged that the task will not be easy.
We have much to do in this winter of peril and significant possibilities. Much to repair, much to restore, much to heal, much to build, and much to gain. Few people in our nation's history have been more challenged or found a time more challenging or difficult than the time we're in now.
And he called for the nation's political discourse to change.
Politics doesn't have to be a raging fire, destroying everything in its path. Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war. And we must reject the culture in which facts themselves are manipulated and even manufactured.
Looking on, predecessors Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, with whom he served as vice president, and Mr. Biden's successor in that office, Mike Pence. The day's theme of America United was carried on by Amanda Gorman, at 22, the youngest inaugural poet in U.S. history.
We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters and conditions of man. And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us.
On this day where we emphasize national unity.
The new president's entire day underscored that idea. from morning mass at St. Matthew's Cathedral with congressional leaders from both parties, to a military pass and review on the Capitol's East Front, and a wreath-laying ceremony with former Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama at Arlington National Cemetery's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. President Biden traveled through a city on high alert. More than 25,000 National Guard troops patrolled a downtown largely off limits to visitors and traffic. Coast Guard vessels kept watch on the Potomac River. Entering the White House for the first time as president, Mr. Biden quickly got down to business, signing 17 executive orders on issues ranging from the pandemic to climate change, and sending Congress his sweeping immigration bill.
Great honor.
In his final hours as president, Donald Trump was busy too, issuing scores of commutations and pardons to allies.
Do you have any regrets about your presidency?
Mr. Trump left Washington this morning, the first time in more than 150 years an outgoing president skipped his successor's inaugural. He never spoke with his successor or even uttered his name in public. Mr. Trump did follow one tradition, leaving a handwritten Oval Office note for his successor. Addressing supporters at Andrews Air Force Base, Mr. Trump pledged to be back in some form.
I will always fight for you. I will be watching, I will be listening, and I will tell you that the future of this country has never been better. I wish the new administration great luck and great success.
President Trump arrived at his Mar-a-Lago resort in South Florida before his successor was sworn in. In Washington, President Biden settled in at the White House, where the challenges of the pandemic, the wounded economy, a polarized nation, and crises yet to come lie ahead. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
And we turn now to our Yamiche Alcindor, who has been at the White House all this day. So, Yamiche, for all the pomp and circumstance of this day, the new president guy has gotten right down to business.
That is right, Judy. After 48 years of government service, Joe Biden is now the 46th president of the United States, and he said he wasn't wasting any time. He signed 17 executive orders, 17 executive actions. They're focused on a number of things that will, I'm told, be the core of his presidency and how he governs. They include him rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, as well as instituting a national mask mandate on federal property. He also is going to be directing agencies to do an equity review, looking at all of their different policies to look at any sort of systemic racism that might be plaguing their agencies. He also directed some of his energy today to immigration reform, saying that DACA recipients, those are people that were brought to this country as undocumented immigrants as minors, that they should be protected. He's also going to be rejoining the World Health Organization. This is Joe Biden saying that he wants to get to business soon. Also, as he was signing in the Oval Office today, he spoke about a letter that President Trump, now former President Trump, left him. Here's what he had to say.
The president wrote a very generous letter. I have it. Because it was private, I will not talk about it until I talk to him, but it was generous.
Now, that, of course, is very interesting, given the fact that President Trump, he encouraged his supporters to storm the Capitol just 2 Wednesdays ago because he believed that Joe Biden was not the rightful winner of this election. But it sounds as though President Trump, in his final moments, even though he skipped inauguration, the first president to do so since 1869, that he did leave something nice to say about Biden that, as of now, is between the two men.
Yes, Yamiche, it raises questions that we all want answers to about exactly what was in that letter, but I guess we'll wait until President Biden shares that with us. But Yamiche, so much of these orders that he is signing are aimed at undoing the Trump legacy, aren't they, including stopping the building of the wall on the border?
That's right, Judy. He's also going to be revoking the Muslim ban that was a central part of President Trump's presidency. He's also going to be rolling back the president's COVID-19 plans, making an entirely new COVID-19 plan, asking the Surgeon General to resign and putting in his own group. This goes, if we can zoom out a little bit, this goes to what President Biden spoke of in his inaugural address. He said that this was a country that was struggling and that we needed to be better than this, talking about the fact fact that there is real issues here when it comes to truth and lies, saying that before God and before the people who witnessed him today take his oath that he was going to level with the American people. He didn't say President Trump's name, but you can insinuate, you can see that he was talking about really turning the page on the Trump era. Another thing to note is that he is going to be building what he says is the most diverse cabinet in history. That, again, is another rebuke for President Trump, who was at times called racist, at times saying that he was, people saying that he filled his government not with a government that looked like the American people. And of course, if we zoom out even more, there is Vice President now, Kamala Harris, the first Black woman, the first South Asian, the first member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, the first African-American sorority to be Vice President. She is poetic justice in some ways to critics of President Trump, because President Trump began his political career questioning the birthplace of the first African-American president. So all of this is really a rebuke on President Trump.
At the same time, this new president is saying he wants to unite the country. So we'll be figuring it out and trying to understand it. And I know you'll be asking a lot of questions starting tonight with the first news conference. Yamiche Alcindor at the White House, thank you.
Thank you.
And now Lisa Desjardins joins us to discuss how the Senate, with its new Democratic majority, will take up the Biden agenda. Lisa, you've been at the Capitol all day long, and it wasn't quiet even after the inauguration, because we saw the new vice president swearing in three new Democratic senators.
That's right, Judy. It's a working night here in the U.S. Capitol. Actually, you can see behind me one of the leaders of the Republican Senate, or the Republican leader in the Senate, John Barrasso, with some National Guard troops. But Judy, in just the last hour or so, the presidency changed hands this morning. This evening, the Senate changed hands. The Senate is now Democratic controlled, but barely. 50-50. Why? Because we saw the swearing in of three new senators again this evening. Those are the two new senators from Georgia, as well as a new senator from California to replace Kamala Harris, now Vice President Harris. And they know that a lot of business needs to get done right away. As Yamiche's reporting, President Biden is eager to get his cabinet filled. First priority here at the Capitol seems to be national security positions. I am told that we expect a vote on one cabinet nominee this hour. One top national security figure. That's Avril Haines for the position of Director of National Intelligence. There was a block on her nomination by Tom Cotton of Arkansas. He has removed that block, I am told, and we expect that nomination to be confirmed this hour.
Very interesting, watching that so closely. And Lisa, it's interesting you're saying the Biden people want so much done quickly, and yet they are looking at an impeachment trial in the Senate, which apparently is going to go forward. That's going to gobble up time and attention, isn't it?
It will. And before we even get to talk about a trial, the Senate has to sort out how it will conduct its own business. Right now, there is no real agreement as to how and when any kind of legislation will come to the floor. Because it is a 50-50 Senate, the leaders, the Republican leader now, Mitch McConnell, and the new Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, have to work out a deal for how they can bring legislation to the floor. They haven't figured that out yet. They haven't figured out the exact composition of committees even. So while Democrats are beginning to operate the Senate, there still is not a process in place to legislate. And because of that, there's not really a clear path forward for how to get the impeachment trial off the ground. It could start at any time because technically House Speaker Nancy Pelosi just has to transmit the article of impeachment. But we all know that everyone is waiting for the Senate to figure out how we'll conduct business. And then you hear some National Guardsmen behind me celebrating, I think, the end of a successful day, they feel.
Long day. Well, we'll be watching, and I know you will, to see how Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell work out the next very next steps. We like the beret. Lisa Desjardins, thank you. Thank you very much. And now to Amna Nawaz, who has been on the National Mall all this day from early morning into tonight. So, Amna, you started out this day looking at the security picture there on the mall at a place that where normally there would be crowds. But as you reported early in the day, that's not what happened.
Not at all, Judy. That's right. You and I both know, anyone who's covered inaugurations in the past knows, this mall is typically chock-a-block full of hundreds of thousands of people who gather here specifically because of the view you get of that west front of the Capitol steps there to watch the swearing-in. That swearing-in is usually met with thunderous applause and cheers. Today, it was met with a deafening silence because, of course, the mall, like much of Washington, D.C., is closed down, shuttered among health concerns in the pandemic and security concerns after that Capitol attack just 2 weeks ago. We are inside what's known as the Red Zone. It's a robust and heavily fortified security perimeter that was set up a few days ago. It's maintained by miles and miles of metal fencing, by several layers of security barriers, and also, as John Yang reported earlier, the presence of 25,000 National Guard troops who have descended from every corner of the country to help secure the inaugural ceremonies today. One group from Texas told us, in fact, they've been working very long hours, sleeping only a few hours every night. And for many of them, it was their first trip to Washington, D.C. ever, so quite a first trip for them. But they were here, of course, to try to prevent some of those same forces that we saw storm the Capitol steps 2 weeks ago from acting again, those white supremacist and conspiracy and anti-government forces who did violently storm the Capitol. Sources tell us, intelligence and national security sources tell us, the online chatter suggests that many of those groups decided against taking any kind of action today, largely because of the security presence, and many of them felt it wasn't worth the risk. But those sources say those same groups are holding their fire potentially for another day. That threat has not gone away. Judy, one other thing I'll mention, sources tell us they were watching today online followers of this QAnon conspiracy theory, a pro-Trump group that we've been reporting on several times over. Many people in this group told us, even on days I spoke to them outside the Capitol attack, that they believe President Trump had some secret plan, some kind of big action he was going to take today on his final day in office that would allow him to stay in power. That, of course, did not happen. And online, many of them are expressing anger and disbelief. More worryingly, some of them are spinning new conspiracy theories about why that didn't happen and what could happen next. Judy, this is evidence of the dangerous disinformation campaigns that we saw emanating from the White House over the last 4 years. And these are just some of the challenges that the Biden administration will inherit as they're coming into office. But at least today, security officials say they are grateful the transfer of power was peaceful. Judy?
Listening to you, Amna, and just shaking our head at what you're saying. But very quickly, I hear you saying, even though the threat was minimal today, we didn't see its presence, authorities are very much on guard in the days and weeks to come.
Absolutely, Judy. They stressed to us that those threats, the same forces that stormed the Capitol 2 weeks ago, they are robust, they persist, and they will be planning future attacks as well. Just because they didn't act today does not mean they won't act in the future. This will be an enormous problem. We heard President Biden address in his inaugural address as well that these are some of the forces they will have to contend with in the years ahead. Judy?
Amna Nawaz, it's enough to keep us all on edge. Thank you very much. Meantime, Nick Schifrin has been reporting on the enormous security operation in the Capitol across this city and across the country, and he joins us now from the streets of Washington. So, Nick, tell us what you're following today.
Yeah, Judy, we talked so much about those 25,000 National Guard troops and the closures, not only where Amna is, about a mile from me or so on the Mall, but the bridges coming in and out of D.C. and the streets. You can see behind me still National Guard and still a checkpoint. They are still checking IDs at this late hour. And that also meant that almost no protesters were able or allowed to get into D.C. today. In fact, the Park Police only approved a single park permit for a single protest group, and that was supposed to take place in something called a free speech zone. I believe we've got some video of that free speech zone. It's basically a pen that was in downtown D.C., and when we went, it was absolutely empty. Protesters clearly just couldn't get there or didn't want to get there. When I talked to military officials, they reiterate what Amna just said, that the unprecedented show of force by the military, the unprecedented closures, was a deterrence factor, keeping away those protesters that they did believe could have come not only today but over the weekend and launched armed protests. At least that's what they were worried about. There were some questions by some lawyers about the extent of the free speech restrictions. But bottom line, the military officials I talked to and the national security officials and the transition officials say that today was about guaranteeing that peaceful transfer of power. And it works not only here, but also across the country. We've collected some video and photos from all 50 state capitals. And basically what we saw across the country, whether Madison, Wisconsin, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Lansing, Michigan, Olympia, Washington, St. Paul, Atlanta, was not only very few protesters, but a large show of force outside those capitals, following really a national campaign by the FBI to try and arrest all those insurrectionists from January 6th. Finally, Judy, you know, the military reiterated again and again leading up to today that there would be no stop in continuity. There would be no loss of the chain of command. But a few hours ago, the Biden transition team had to send out an email about the acting secretaries. Biden starts his presidency without any national security officials already in place. And it occurred to me that what Senator Blunt said, the Republican chairman of the inaugural committee, holds true. He said that, look, in this time of transition, when it comes to national security, in some ways, America is at its most vulnerable. But also, America is at its most powerful, proving the perseverance of democracy on a day like today.
No question. And that echoes what we did hear from President Biden in his inaugural remarks, that democracy endures, perseveres. Thank you very much, Nick Schifrin, for all your work all this day. Thank you. For more on this history-making day, I'm here in our studio with James Fallows, who's been watching at my side here as the inauguration events have unfolded. He is a journalist. He's a longtime writer for The Atlantic and former speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. Jim Fallows, thank you, and thank you for being here all day as we watched everything happen. As you think back on this speech, a lot of different remarks, and we used some excerpts of it earlier. What is ringing true to you?
So what strikes me, we were talking earlier today about how every inaugural speech, is essentially two stories. The story of who we are, we the country, and the story of who I am, I as the person who's taking over responsibility. I think that the new President Biden answered both those stories very clearly. The story of who we are is a country with very severe problems right now. And he sounded quite realistic about the pandemic, economic polarization and collapse, political friction, and the realm of untruths. But also, just to continue, that we are a country with problems, but that can be better, that can get better. So that's the story of the country. The story of himself is somebody who was plain-spoken, it was not a highfalutin speech, right. Empathetic, knows that fate can deal you an unfair hand, and wants to compromise. I think the line that stuck with me is, my whole soul is in this, the exercise of pulling us together. So that stays with me.
We keep coming back to the theme of unity, how it's almost desperate. Joe Biden is almost desperate to bring the country together. He kept coming back to that again and again. In these remarks and in remarks he's made in the days and weeks and months of his campaign and after the election.
I think something that is effective about his rhetoric, again, it's not going to be inscribed in the oratory books, but he has been the same person over the past 40 plus years and the past 6 months from the Democratic convention through the election, essentially saying, I want to represent everybody. I recognize this is a diverse country. I will do my best to convince you. If you disagree, okay, but we are better off if we're all together. And I think that was a theme that went through even the symbolism of having the former presidents from different parties going to Arlington, the wonderful poem from Amanda Gorman talking about the process of becoming for this country. So I think we had from President Biden a notably faith-inspired speech. It was clear that he was a man who takes his religion seriously and thought that his duty of his secular faith now was to help bring a divided country together.
You started out by saying this is not a person, in so many words, of soaring rhetoric or soaring oratory, but it felt real. I mean, it felt like this is who Joe Biden is, as you said.
Yes, both those things are true. There's a kind of rhetoric that would be authentic to Barack Obama or to Bernie Sanders or to Elizabeth Warren. And if Joe Biden read those words, that would sound inauthentic to him. I felt as if we were hearing somebody in his own voice, his own sensibility, his own word choice, his own emphases. And so it seemed like a real person we were seeing.
Jim Fallows, you've looked at a lot of presidents and what they've said in their inaugural addresses. How much have those addresses sent a signal told the country something about the way they would govern?
We can look back 4 years when Donald Trump had his American Carnage inaugural, which was unfortunately a signal. I think for most inaugural addresses, they do give a new president some kind of margin of error, some honeymoon from a public saying, we recognize what you're trying to do. You're telling us who we are, who you are. We're going to look for the best. And I think that Joe Biden did that, at least for today.
Jim Fallows, who has watched a lot of inaugural speeches, has written some himself. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
Appreciate it. Meantime, an important glass ceiling was broken today when Kamala Harris became the country's first female vice president. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton is a longtime civil rights activist. She represents the District of Columbia in the Congress, and she joins us now. Eleanor Holmes Norton, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thank you so much for being here. Tell us what you took away from today.
From today, Judy, you saw the effect of arrests after January 6th insurrection and tightened security that followed it. Sitting where I was as a member of Congress, you couldn't see that. But if you represent the district as I do, you saw it every day. I live on Capitol Hill. The mayor had to get a police escort to get me through to the Capitol. That's just how tight it was. I certainly hope this will relax. And Judy, I think it will, because I think this security has had a deterrent effect. We all around the country in the states, we saw very little in the way of demonstrations. They were very puny. I think that had we had the kind of force at the Capitol when Trump inspired an insurrection, that we would not have even seen that near as bad as it was. And I certainly think that the deterrent effect was felt throughout the country today.
No doubt that would have made a difference on January the 6th. But it was, as you say, under very different circumstances. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, let me ask you this. What gives you confidence that because today was quiet, that will continue to be that way?
Well, one thing that gives me confidence is that Trump is no longer in power. So you're not going to see people, particularly when you see what kind of a job the FBI is doing. The FBI is rounding up hundreds of people, and now on social media, they're able to do it. They're rounding them up, they are arresting them, and they are charging them. So people have to decide, is this really worth it? And I think we're seeing the beginnings of that today with the puny demonstrations, even in the states. And when I think the effect of the FBI arrests is having its own effect on individuals. So I'm not among those who said just wait. And I saw some of that in your earlier news report that it could get much worse. Well, I'll give you an example. There were to be demonstrations here on Monday. Why didn't they occur?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that there had already begun to have an effect, the tightened security that we are now finally seeing here in the Capitol.
Well, I know everyone would certainly like to think that times are going to stay safe for as long as we can imagine into the future. But I also want to ask you about the historic first today, Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, and that is Kamala Harris not only being the first woman, but being the first Black, the first Asian to become vice president. You've been involved. You go back to the 1960s. You've been very active in thinking about these things. What did that mean to you today?
Well, I think we've seen perhaps, I think, as many as six vice presidents become president. This president is the oldest president ever. He could decide not to go for another term. But I think she is really in line to become president of the United States. And what a first that would mean. The first woman and the first Black.
The first, after President Obama, the first Black woman.
Black woman. First Black woman.
How much?
Yes.
Let me ask you about the what Joe Biden is trying to do. He has a fairly ambitious agenda in terms of what he wants to see spent to fight, to help people in this pandemic economy. Do you see among Republicans you talk to a willingness to work with him on this?
Well, he has one advantage, and that is that he has worked with Republicans his entire life. The man's been in public life and in the Congress for more than 30 years. So he starts out with an advantage that no Democratic president has had. I think that there will be some chastened Republicans. I was pleased to see so many of them show up and speak at the inauguration. And I think that it's important to also recognize this is a moderate Democrat. That means, it seems to me, particularly with his experience in the Senate itself, that he is in a position to find rapport across the aisle.
What do you think, just in the very little bit of time, few seconds we have left, what do you think he should be focusing on first? And do you favor the impeachment trial taking up days to come early in his term?
I don't favor the impeachment trial. I think the first 100 days must be focused on what it should be the focus of this presidency. Now, I'm not going to say D.C. statehood, but I'm pleased that he is for D.C. statehood and that we have the House, the Senate, and the presidency, which puts us in a good stead to get it. But his agenda is laid out for him, Judy. He's got to focus on the virus. He's got to then look at the economy. That's written for him. And I think he's been playing spoken that that's what he's going to do.
Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, representing the District of Columbia, thank you so much. Very good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
And now for how Republicans in Congress are viewing the new president and his agenda. For that, I'm joined by Representative Nicole Malliotakis of New York. She just began her first term in the House and yesterday was named an assistant Republican whip. Representative Malliotakis, thank you so much for joining us. So you're joining us from your home city, Staten Island, New York. What did you, I assume you did watch and listen to the inaugural ceremony today. Tell us what you thought of what you saw and what you heard.
Yeah, unfortunately, I couldn't make it back in time to Washington to complete the required health screening to attend in person, but I did watch from my home. And look, I was very open-minded. I'm going into this with an open mind. I want to work with everyone and anyone who will put America first and help us overcome this pandemic, get our economy back on track, restore the American jobs that we lost over the last several months. I certainly believe that when Joe Biden says he wants to bring this country together, that he means it. The issue becomes that there is a lot of division, and the division, I believe, is caused because there's just different paths that individuals want to take this country. And I think that we have to find a way to find that common ground and work together. And I'm certainly willing to do that where we can find that common ground. But I'm also mindful that, you know, I represent the district of Staten Island, Southern Brooklyn. I'm always going to do what's in the best interest of my constituents. And if I see this administration doing something that harms them or our nation, I'm going to push back.
We heard President Biden today say, in so many words, it's possible to disagree with each other without getting into essentially a political war. Do you think it's possible to disagree in a more civil way than what we've seen in the recent years?
I really hope so, and I think it's incumbent upon all of us to try to bring the temperature down a bit and try to debate individuals on issues. You know, we shouldn't be the political discourse we've seen over the last several years by members of Congress, by individuals in the political arena has been damaging. And I think social media has a lot to do with it, quite frankly, because everyone feels that they can just go on social media, on Twitter or on Facebook, and give every thought that's in their head. I think we got to go back to the basics of governing, which means that we need to debate on the House floor on the merits of issues and not attack individuals personally. I think where Joe Biden has an opportunity to work with the Republican members of Congress is by looking for ways to find that center, that middle ground that puts America first, not to allow the socialist squad, individuals like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who have an extreme agenda for our nation, who fundamentally want to change our nation towards socialism, to take control. And with the margin being so close between majority and minority in the House of Representatives, he does have that opportunity to work with Republicans and to push forward an agenda when it comes to infrastructure and transportation and making those necessary improvements to getting our economy back on track, to bringing a lot of our production home from places like China, and making sure that we are actually working diligently to distribute this vaccine as quickly as possible and push states like ours in New York to reopen its economy and get people back to work.
I'm sure you know that Representative Ocasio-Cortez and some of the others would say they do not consider themselves socialists, but we can debate that another time.
Well, self-proclaimed socialists, though. They self-proclaimed and said they were socialists.
I do want to ask you about, you did vote to object to the electoral vote counts from the states of Arizona and Pennsylvania in the House. Do you consider Joe Biden legitimately elected as president?
Joe Biden had more electoral votes than just Arizona and Pennsylvania. And with the certification that took place that day and with the swearing in today, he is the legitimate president. And we must do the best to find common grounds to work together. I do believe, though, that there are certain irregularities that existed in our election system. We need to make sure that we solidify the integrity of this system. As you know, since in the last couple of weeks alone, there have been arrests in Texas and Louisiana for election fraud. And there are tens of millions of Americans who are concerned about the integrity of the system. And so, you know, I'm a proud co-sponsor of a new bill, the Save Democracy Act, that will look to further solidify the integrity of our system, make sure that we do have voter ID laws, making sure that we don't allow for automatic voter registration with a foreign document, as is going to happen in the state of New York, unless the person opts out when applying for a driver's license, and making sure that we prohibit certain harvesting tactics and other safeguards that we're supporting are in that measure as well. But I think that, look, we only wanted to shed light, in my view, my vote was to shed light to some of the irregularities, some of the questions that were never actually heard in court due to time constraints. And I think that the American people just owe that. We owe it to them to prove that our election system is safeguarded and any of these concerns are addressed.
My reading of it is that people don't object to further investigation, but that so far there's been no evidence of any significant amount of fraud. But finally, I do want to ask you about President Biden's proposal, additional $1,400 in pandemic relief, direct payments to people, other measures to try to give an immediate boost to the economy. Are you in favor of that?
Well, I will certainly look at the bill that he presents. I'm mindful that we're moving toward a $30 trillion debt in this country. And so we have to make sure that any legislation is tailored specifically to the people who are unemployed due to this crisis and also to businesses that have been mandated to be closed because of governors like Governor Cuomo. So I think that's something that we need to work together on, and I will certainly be reviewing legislation that comes before me to make sure that it best meets the needs of those I represent.
Representative Nicole Malliotakis, newly elected from the state of New York, congratulations on your election, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Former President Donald Trump's final hours in office, as it turned out, included one last sweep of pardons and commutations involving 144 people in all. Stephanie Tsai has a closer look.
Judy, the list of 74 pardons and 70 commutations included many individuals championed by celebrities and criminal justice advocates, but also notable Trump political allies. He pardoned his former White House aide, Steve Bannon, who faced fraud charges. A big campaign fundraiser, Elliot Broidy, who had admitted to breaking foreign lobbying laws. He commuted the sentence of longtime Democrat and former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, convicted on racketeering and other counts. And he pardoned famous rapper Lil Wayne, who was facing a weapons charge. To talk about who was and was not on the list, I'm joined by Dan Coble, law professor at Capital University in Ohio. Professor, thank you so much for being with us. I want to hone in on the political allies that former President Trump now pardoned or commuted the sentences for, particularly Steve Bannon. Bannon has not even been put on trial for fraud charges yet. How unusual is that, and why is that significant?
That is highly unusual, Stephanie, because the courts have not even decided whether he's guilty. So typically, acceptance of a pardon is an admission that one is guilty of the offense with which they're charged. So Bannon has never gone through the justice system, and the other branches of government have not had an opportunity to weigh in on his misdeeds, or perhaps he's innocent. So in many ways, the short-circuiting of the system is highly unusual.
Short-circuiting is one word. We also know that President Trump did not go through the traditional Department of Justice vetting process for many of these cases on the commutation and pardons list. What other precedents were set during the Trump presidency that should be concerning, especially to a constitutional law professor like yourself?
Many people are highly troubled by the president's pardoning approach, because it really was the worst of both worlds. By not going through the Justice Department's process, the president ignored thousands of ordinary people who had applied for pardons or commutations, typically pardons, in order to cleanse their records, in order to obtain employment opportunities or things like that. Indeed, Trump closed without any action by far the most pardon and commutation requests in history. So he was inactive for the vast majority of requests, yet he was active for those with whom he was connected or had some sort of sympathy. So it really was the worst of both worlds in that it avoided the regular pardon process that we need to make justice humane, which is what the founders of the Constitution wanted. Yet it shows in the ones that were granted that there are really two tiers of justice, one for those who are connected to the president and one for everybody else.
What does the sheer number and nature of the pardons granted by former President Trump say about his presidency and his legacy, Professor?
The numbers are not that unusual for a Republican president. Indeed, President H.W. Herbert Walker Bush only granted about 77 pardons and commutations. By the time Trump is done, he will have between 200 and 300. So I'd have to tally up the exact number. The pardon attorney's office has not published those yet. But his numbers are not as out of whack with modern presidents, but it's who he pardoned that is highly unusual.
Dan Coble, law professor at Capital University in Ohio. We certainly appreciate your perspective, especially on this momentous day.
Great. Thank you for having me, Stephanie.
In In the day's other news, as President Biden took office, the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 kept climbing, past 405,000. At the same time, a number of states reported they are running out of vaccine supplies. The CDC estimated nearly 36 million doses have gone out to the states, but so far, only 2 million people have received the full course of two doses. Overseas, world governments largely welcome President Biden's inauguration. In Brussels, the president of the European Commission voiced hope for much better relations with the U.S. in the post-Trump era.
This new dawn in America is the moment we've been waiting for so long. Europe is ready for a new start with our oldest and most trusted partner.
Meanwhile, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani urged President Biden to rejoin the 2015 nuclear deal that the U.S. withdrew from under President Trump. China voiced hope today for new cooperation with the U.S. under the Biden administration. Beijing also imposed sanctions on former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and other Trump administration officials. They're accused of violating Chinese sovereignty and disrupting relations. The sanctions bar them from doing business with China and from entering the country. The government of Israel raced to approve more housing in East Jerusalem and the West Bank settlements just before President Trump left office. An Israeli watchdog group says that nearly 2,600 new units got the green light. President Biden is expected to return the U.S. to a policy of strongly opposing settlement expansion. And back in this country, Wall Street had its best inauguration day in 36 years on hopes for more economic stimulus. Major indexes finished at new highs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 257 points to close at 31,188. The Nasdaq rose 260 points to 2%, and the S&P 500 added nearly 53 points. Still to come on the news, our public art stands in for crowds at a ceremony subdued by COVID-19 and security concerns. And students write open letters to the new president, expressing their hopes for change in America.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we've seen, today's inauguration featured unusual imagery, a response to the unusual circumstances. The temporary public art is intended to represent the American people and to unify the country. Jeffrey Brown has our look. It's part of our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
In the sky above Washington, pillars of light, 56 in all, symbolizing the 50 states, the District of Columbia, and five U.S. territories. On the ground, a field of flags, nearly 200,000 of them, representing the millions of people unable to attend due to pandemic and ramped-up security measures. An inauguration without precedent, imagery to match.
This is something that is meant to be evocative for everybody.
Adam Barron, Deputy Director of Events for the Presidential Inaugural Committee, helped create and oversee the installations. American flags of all sizes, flags of the states and territories. Barron says the idea grew from looking at past inauguration scenes.
When you look down the mall, it's not just the people that you see. There are just these thousands of waving American flags that represent people from all stripes coming together to celebrate a new administration. And so we sort of took that image and we wanted to have those waving flags represent people that could not safely or smartly come together and gather this year.
So the imagery is really from inaugurations past, but without the people in a sense.
Yeah, we knew we had to do something that was still celebratory to commemorate the importance of the moment, but that was smart and thoughtful of the health and safety of everybody involved.
Of course, the intended audience was, as was so much now, remote. Public art on public space now closed to the public. And not just any space, but the National Mall, home to enduring symbols of American democratic values. Philip Kennicott is a Pulitzer Prize-winning critic for The Washington Post.
In Washington, we're just 2 weeks out from having seen a violent mob storm the Capitol. What we see here is, in a sense, a kind of fantasy of the crowd as orderly, as collective, as gathering in proximity, but in a constructive way.
Constructive, yet different for this very different moment. Kennicott points to the evocative shafts of lights that once illuminated the absent World Trade Center Twin Towers after 9/11, or the rows of orderly flags familiar at cemeteries and battlefields. Those evoke sorrow. These images, he thinks, might offer something more hopeful.
By using the National Mall in this way, they're inviting us not just to sort of be spectators, but to kind of project ourselves into that crowd and feel as somehow we're more than just passive participants in this.
You're saying we as citizens need to find a new way to connect to public spaces, to public events, to politics itself. What role does the art play?
In some ways, that is an effort to get us to go beyond the fairly passive and reactive role that we have taken up with democracy through things like social media, through television, and actually get out there and do something, be physically present. We can't do that at the moment, but this is making us, in a way, yearn to be in that space a little more tangibly than we might if we just watched it on television as we used to do.
That asks a lot of what is, after all, a temporary art installation. But we're a country in need of a lot just now. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
So, how does this historic inauguration look to young people? Our student reporting labs reached out to our network of high school journalism programs to find out what they hope the new administration accomplishes. Here they are in their own words.
Dear Mr. President and Madam Vice President.
Dear Mr. President.
Dear Mr. President.
I hope you will consider this message.
As someone who's currently COVID positive and quarantining in their bedroom, what's really important to me is seeing that the pandemic is handled with urgency and care.
My hope for you as a president is that you can create more jobs for the people of the U.S.
I think seeing swift and forceful action taken to combat global climate change is going to be something incredibly important.
VP Kamala Harris, I hope you know that being in your position is a huge inspiration for Black women among this country. And I hope you know that it shows that with hard work and dedication, we can accomplish all of our goals.
I hope to see a progressive plan in combating climate change.
Continue to bring money back to middle-class families, continue to rise the poor out of unemployment and back into jobs in our country.
Do you plan on addressing this volatile split in America right now? And if so, how? Do you think you can repair this break?
I put my faith in you to end systemic racism and tear down all the barriers that come with it.
So inspirational, and you can watch the entire We the Young People inauguration special. That is on our website. And also on the NewsHour online right now, Black women representing the oldest African-American sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, are cheering as Vice President Kamala Harris, a member of their own organization, makes history today. Find out more about that reaction on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And later tonight on PBS, you can watch special coverage of the inaugural evening festivities. Bruce Springsteen, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and other artists will perform in an event hosted by Tom Hanks. There will also be remarks from President Biden and Vice President Harris. That is Celebrating America tonight at 8 p.m., 7 Central, right here on PBS. And that is the NewsHour on this historic night. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.